of my room that overlooks a square, where people are walking quickly in every direction. There's a woman ducking into a bakery. I smell the goods from here. Warm bread and something sweet, like donuts. A man with a white cane and a seeing-eye standard poodle expertly taps his way through the middle of the square. I'm amazed that of all the people winding in and around him, he never stumbles, never even brushes shoulders with anyone. All of the streets within my immediate view are pedestrian-only, so there's no roar of cars to disturb my interpretation of this extraordinary spring morning. My third favorite thing about Florence, the food. It is incredible. In even the smallest, plainest trattoria, you can find the best meal you've ever eaten. Homemade pasta with a pomodoro sauce that tastes as if someone just picked the tomatoes from a summer garden, the olive oil fresh and fruity. Last night I had dinner at a little place I happened to pass on my way back from the Ponte Vecchio, where I had browsed the wonderful jewelry shops that occupy either side of the famous old bridge. The decor of the trattoria was simple and rustic, heavy wood tables and comfy farm-style chairs. I sat by a window where I could see the people passing by and took my time eating. The owner of the trattoria walked from table to table welcoming people. I was one of the few Americans there, but when he approached me, he did so in English and asked me what I thought of the dessert. I told him that I wasn't sure I could find words to express it well enough, and it was clear this pleased him greatly. When I left, he asked me to come back again, and I said I most definitely would. I am now beginning day 3 of my stay in Florence. There's something about the immediate absorption of the beauty in this place that makes it feel as if I've been here much longer. I have done nothing more with my days than wander street to street, not even using a map, letting them lead me where they would. Passing shops with beautiful leather goods, journals, satchels, and purses. Shoe stores in which I want no fewer than a dozen pair. And bakeries with the most mouth-watering breads I've ever seen, mounds of them fresh from the oven. 2 full days of this. In my adult life, I have never known such a luxurious expenditure of time. In fact, not since my childhood when a day knew no schedule aside from play and sleep. Certainly not in my regular life, where a day is normally sectioned off by appointments and fundraising meetings and grocery shopping, and all of those things that somehow manage to steal most of the best parts of our waking hours. I wonder how it is that we go along, year after year, never questioning the routines we've set for ourselves, never wondering if it could be different. I feel as if I've opened a door and discovered a way of life that makes so much more sense to me. A slower pace that allows me to actually see the beauty around me, hear the song and the sounds, and feel appreciation for it all. I take another sip of my coffee and wonder if this would have been the same for me had Ty actually come. I have barely completed the thought before admitting the answer. No, it would not have. With Ty, there's always a sense of impatience to get to the next thing, the next case, the next rung up the law firm ladder. He is constantly checking his watch, and I've wondered many times if it's because he would rather be doing something other than what he is doing with me at that moment. If I'm honest, I've wondered if there was somewhere else he would rather be. Someone else he would rather be with. Whatever the reason, this habit of his makes everything we do together feel rushed and incapable of comparing to whatever it is that he's anxious to get on to. I realize now that to wander Florence without a schedule would make no sense whatsoever to Ty. He would see it as a place to be conquered. The most famous tourist attractions viewed and checked off a "we've done that" list. So that in the end it would seem more about completing the list than actually seeing what there is to see. Before coming here, I really didn't question that. It is Ty's nature. It's who he is. If it wasn't who I am, Somehow that failed to be significant, at least in any way that matters. The sun is now draping itself across the terrace, its warmth caressing my face. I lean back in the chair and close my eyes, willing myself not to think about Ty. Even as I do, a thorn of worry makes itself known. I haven't let Kylie know that I took this trip without her daddy. I have no idea if Ty has done so. My guess would be yes. Guilt prods me out of my chair. I retrieve my laptop from the room and bring it back to the terrace, popping the lid open and waiting for it to find the hotel's wireless signal. Once it does, I log into my email account. Surprisingly, there are no new messages from Ty. But there is one from Kylie. I open it with some reluctance, selfishly not wanting her certain disapproval to pop my bubble of happiness. Even so, I cannot help but read what she has written. Mom, Daddy is worried sick about you. Please call him as soon as you get this. I can't believe you went without him. K. And there it is, the instant feeling of something almost like shame. It's not the first time Kylie has put me in my place. As an only child, she's really good at manipulation. But maybe that's more my fault and Ty's fault than it is Kylie's. At some point in her childhood, and I'm not even sure I could say when, a tug of war for her affections had come into play between Ty and me, each of us seeking her approval whether we realized it or not. I wonder now if that was the first symptom of erosion in our relationship. The need to prove to the other who was more valuable in our family structure. If I had to say which of us pulled ahead at some point, I will admit it was Ty. Before age 12, Kylie was Mama's girl. I could do no wrong in her eyes. She wanted to dress like me, smell like me. How many conversations did we have? In the car, going grocery shopping, or a trip to the library? About how she would never leave home. That even after she got married, she and her husband would live with us. Maybe they could build another part to the house, she said, but she would never leave home. And she would only marry someone who would agree to that. As the adult, I knew it was simply her age talking. That the picture she painted was nothing more than a fairy tale. But it felt so nice to be that loved by her. To think that she never wanted to be apart. And then, not long after she turned 12, things started to change. They were little shifts in the beginning, like the tremors way down deep in the earth, predicting a quake to come. I felt them like pinpricks to the skin. One night when we'd gone out to dinner, she said my dress looked frumpy. A year before, she had called that same dress classy in the way Coco Chanel thought women should dress. Frumpy hurt. It sounds silly, and I could admit it even then. But there was a change in the tide. At the same time, Ty grew in stature where Kylie was concerned. She wanted to know more about what he did every day. Became fascinated with the trials he was a part of, with the criminals he had represented in various cases. And while she had once wanted to be a photographer, like I once was, now she wanted to be a lawyer, like Ty. He would take her with him to the office on Saturday mornings, letting her read depositions, giving her some minor task to complete within them. She would come home elated by the fact that she had helped him and earned his lavish praise. And as Ty began to be the recipient of her obvious affections, I became diminished in her eyes. At 13 and 14, it seemed that a day never passed that we did not end up in an argument over some difference of opinion about what she should or should not wear to school. Tank tops that showed cleavage, skirts that were inches from being close to meeting the dress code, and boys. That was probably the biggest divider. Kylie wanted to date. Like all her friends were doing, she said. Being dropped off at the movies or at the mall to wander around hour after hour, hand in hand. Ty and I had always agreed that she would not date until she was 16. This was the restriction my mother had set for me. and it was one I came to believe in because of how close I got to doing something extremely stupid when I was 13, and a 17-year-old boy wanted to take me out. Of course I thought I should be allowed to go. My mother, however, stood her ground and would not relent. I shared this with Kylie several times, but to her, there was no comparison between the world she lived in and the teenage world I had lived in. They might as well have occurred on different planets for as relevant as she found my advice. The gap of distance between us continued to increase to a point of actual heartache on my part. If I had hopes of maturity bringing new focus to Kylie's attitude, it was completely lost on the day she turned 16. She had asked to borrow one of my sweaters for a party she was going to that night. I told her where it was in my closet, and she had run upstairs to get it. I had been busy making her cake in the kitchen and didn't notice how long she'd been gone until I glanced at the clock and realized it had been almost an hour. Concerned, I called up the stairs but did not get an answer. I walked up, looked in her room, and found her in my closet. She was sitting in the middle of the floor, holding the red leather diary I kept as a teenager. I stared at her, my lips parting without any sound coming out. I finally managed to say, How did you find that? A button popped off the sweater and I couldn't find it, so I looked under the dresser. I saw this, stuck up under the drawer. That's mine. You should have asked first. She'd closed the cover, softly, too softly, looked at me and said, Why did you never tell me? Because in the end, Kylie, it didn't matter. You getting pregnant and only getting married because of that doesn't matter? Your daddy and I would have gotten married anyway. Surely you know that. No, I don't know that. And that's not how it looks. Here, she said, opening the diary and flipping to a page where I knew exactly what I had written. I wish I had never said yes, she read. My heart caught in my throat. I struggled to find the words to explain to her. Oh, Kylie, I was 19 years old, barely a sophomore in college. I was scared of what my parents would say, scared of having a baby, scared of letting go of every dream I had for myself. That was who wrote those words, a very different me from who I was after I figured out the right thing to do. And what was that? She'd asked, tears in her voice. To marry your daddy and to have you. So that is what I did. She looked back at the page, her eyes taking in the words. But you weren't even sure that you loved him. That's what you said here. I wasn't that much older than you are now. Try to understand that. You try to understand, Mom. You try to understand that what I thought was true about you and Daddy wasn't true at all. I love your father, I said. You know I do. I've always wondered, you know, she'd said, rubbing a thumb across the cover of the journal. I knew there was something. Kylie, don't, I said, starting to reach for her. No, you don't, she'd said, tossing the journal at my feet and running from the closet and out of the room. I leaned against the wall, slid down to the floor with my knees bent against my chest. I felt as if someone had taken a wrecking ball to a life I had so carefully put together. It lay around me in shards and smithereens, and I wondered if Kylie's anger would ever dissipate. Things between us were never the same after that day. I had tried so hard to fix things with her. But she had closed a door between us, and no matter how many times I tried to explain why we hadn't told her, she was unyielding in her refusal to let me in again. Her relationship with Ty, however, continued to flourish. She spent even more time with him at the office when she wasn't in school. In her eyes, he was everything that she wanted to be. He had her respect and admiration, and I had neither. To say it hurt came nowhere near describing how her rejection felt. I kept telling myself that eventually things would smooth out again, and she would forgive me for whatever wrong she thought I had done. I couldn't bring myself to ever talk to Ty about what had happened that day. To do so would mean telling him what Kylie had found, and admitting the awful doubts I'd had after finding out that I was pregnant. Somehow, digging all of that up again, re-examining it with Ty possibly reacting in the same way Kylie had, I didn't have the courage to do it. I stare at the computer screen now, my daughter's words at the bottom of the email. I can't believe you went without him. I imagine the conversations the two of them have had about what I've done, that maybe I've gone a little crazy because this is so out of character for me. I hit reply and begin an email laced with apology and reassurance. Dear Kylie, I know this must not make any sense to you, and I'm sorry for any worry I've caused. Please understand that this was something I've always wanted to do. Your daddy decided that he couldn't go, and so I'm visiting a place I've always wanted to see. I will be in touch soon. Love, Mom. I hit send and hear the whoosh of the email as it flies from my inbox to hers. A yawning feeling of loneliness settles over me. I wonder how it's possible to reach this point in life, married with a family, and be this lonely. I hate my own self-pity. I mostly refuse to allow myself to indulge in it. But I can't deny that it hurts. I wonder, not for the first time, if it's always going to be this way. Ty and Kylie on one side of the fence, and me on the other. The thought swamps me with an awful feeling of regret. I start to close the laptop, spot my cursor blinking in its nosy Google search box. My hands automatically slide to the keyboard. I type in his name, hit enter, and blink at the number of results returned by my search. 6,897,512. That really shouldn't be a surprise, I guess. He is, after all, a rock star. Ren Sawyer, lead singer, TemporalTheBand.com. Every time my encounter with him pries itself into my thoughts, I instantly light up with the heat of embarrassment. Until now, I've resisted the urge to find out anything more about him. I can't really say why I've given in to curiosity now. Rebellion, maybe? In response to Kylie's email? I don't know. Maybe that's just an excuse. Maybe it's just old-fashioned curiosity. I click on the first link to an article in USA Today about the conclusion of a recent tour. There's a photo of him at the top of the page, a gorgeous young woman I vaguely recognize as a model next to him. In the caption below, her name is linked with his, and I realize who she is. Gretchen Maha. She certainly looks like someone who would be with him. It would be hard to say who was more beautiful, him or her. I almost talk myself out of reading the article, but my gaze is pulled to the type. By most accounts, the Temporal Tour came to a highly successful conclusion on its last stop in Charlotte, North Carolina. Ticket sales for the 30-city tour topped the group's previous records. Speculation continues as to whether the group will produce another album. Band manager Stuart Langston is quoted as saying, "There is no question as to whether the band will go to the studio for another album." Questions have surfaced regarding the performance of lead singer Ren Sawyer at the tour's last concert in Charlotte. A concert-goer who had flown from Minneapolis to see the show with tickets for front-row seats told a Charlotte newspaper that something went very wrong in the last two songs. She claims that Sawyer became pale and shaky. Having attended a concert in every one of the band's individual tours, she stated, "I have never seen him leave the stage and not return for an encore." Questions directed at the band's manager were dismissed as nothing more than unfounded speculation. Sawyer's current girlfriend, model Gretchen Maha, was seen in New York City last night at Club Scout with another member of the band, drummer Tommy Rainieri. Sawyer was said to not be in attendance. I click out of the article, feeling a little like a voyeur peeping in through a window to Ren Sawyer's personal life. Granted, the article appeared in USA Today for anyone to read. Even so, I feel as if I've wandered into some place I shouldn't be. This time I follow through with closing my laptop, getting up from the desk chair and walking back to the terrace for a last sip of now lukewarm coffee. The street below has come to full life. Tourists wandering among the locals headed for the next attraction on their checklists. I don't want to think about him, but I can't seem to stop myself from wondering what happened at the end of the concert in Charlotte. The concert that had taken place the night before we flew across the Atlantic on the same airplane. I try to think if I had noticed anything similar to what the concert-goer described, but my memory would not be the most accurate considering my state of inebriation. Even so, he had seemed normal, whatever that is for a rock star. I have to wonder what exactly could be so horrible in a life like the one Ren Sawyer leads. Fans waiting for him wherever he goes, a supermodel girlfriend on his arm, and, too, the recognition of being really great at something you love to do. Maybe like most lives, that is simply the surface. The outer coating the rest of the world sees that in no way suggests what might be beneath. I suppose my own life is a good example of this. On the outside, I have pretty much everything a woman my age could want. A successful husband, a beautiful, intelligent daughter, an enormous house in a great neighborhood. If you're standing back looking from a distance, it does look really good. I can't deny that. But there are cracks. I feel a little ashamed in admitting this, because maybe I really have nothing to complain about. No one has a perfect life. Not even, I suppose, someone like Ren Sawyer. I wonder if his girlfriend will be meeting him in Rome, if maybe she is already there. Will she be able to help fix whatever went wrong for him at his last concert? If I had to guess, I would say yes. What man wouldn't allow himself to be fixed by someone like her? But then I think about my own hurt. I wonder if it is even possible for someone else to fix us. If maybe it is only possible for us to fix ourselves.
9. Ren. I sleep for 34 hours straight. If you don't count getting up to go to the bathroom 3 times and twice for a glass of water. This time when I start to wake, I'm no longer tired. I feel that immediately. The leaden weight of physical fatigue is gone. I wait, hopeful that the mental fatigue will also be gone. But the weight on my chest is still there, heavy, gray, and I'm suddenly angry to acknowledge its presence. I want it gone. I hate what it does to me. Hate how I do not have the energy to push it away. I know I should. I just cannot find an angle from which to attempt to get enough leverage to move it. Every possible avenue for escape seems an impossible effort. The curtains in the room are closed, but the seam at the middle where the two are pulled together is broken by a crack of sunlight. I need to get up. I will get up. I will order coffee, take a shower, eject myself out of this room and into the world. A ball cap and sunglasses, and I will go mostly unrecognized. Here I can wander the streets alone. At first this sounds good to me. Alone means no pressures from anything related to the business. No decisions to make. No arguments to settle between band members. This is what I've wanted, and I tell myself it will be good. I roll over, swing my legs to the side of the bed, and sit up with my elbows on my knees. That's when I think of her. The woman I met on the plane coming over. I remember her face in the airport when she'd seen me standing in the middle of all those screaming girls. The surprise that widened her eyes made her lips part slightly. I had liked it better when she didn't know who I was. I'd seen the transformation in her face the way I had seen it in others too many times to count. Before, she'd thought I was some regular guy she'd had a moment with. A moment that, under other circumstances, we might have both acted on. Once she'd seen the other me, the one signing autographs for teenage girls, all of that had melted away, as if it never existed. I call downstairs, and the coffee arrives in minutes, even though it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I down 3 cups and wait for the caffeine to kick in. I spend a good 15 minutes in the shower. One, because it feels good to get clean again. And two, if I'm honest, because getting out will mean having to follow through on leaving the hotel room. I finally force myself out, dry off, and then wrap one of the hotel's extra thick towels around my waist. I wipe the fog from the bathroom mirror, and there I am, staring at myself. I could use a haircut. My eyes are red despite all the sleep. I wonder what's happened to the energy I once saw in my own gaze, the energy that pulled me forward day to day, made me want to reach for the next rung with the kind of determination that didn't take no for an answer. It's gone. I can see that. Feel that. In the mirror, I see a shell of my former self. Breakable, weary. I unzip my leather shaving case, pull out my toothbrush and a tube of toothpaste, and brush my teeth. I reach in the case for a razor, and my hand hits the plastic bottle I haven't let myself think about since putting it in there after the concert in Charlotte. I pick it up, stare at the label where my name is written. Prescribed to Ren Sawyer, 30 tablets. Only there are 60. 2 bottles in one because I deliberately held on to a month's worth before having the prescription refilled. I stare at the bottle for a long time, thinking how easy it would be to down the lot of them and simply go back to bed. Not have to live another moment with the guilt eating a hole inside of me. The lure of this option is so tempting that I have to anchor my hands to the sink counter to keep from giving in to it. I hear my brother's voice, the promise we'd made to each other when we first started to hit it big. "So here's the deal," Colby had said one night after we'd just written a new song together. "No alcoholism, no drug habits, no ending up dead in a hotel room. Promise me neither one of us will end up a rock and roll cliché." At the time, it hadn't seemed like such a difficult thing to promise. Drugs and alcohol had never been our thing. Women, well, that was a different story, for us both. I let myself picture the headlines. Temporal lead singer found dead in Rome Hotel. I cram the bottle back in the case, zip it shut, and shove it inside the cabinet below the sink. I get dressed quickly, jeans, t-shirt, ball cap. I grab a pair of dark sunglasses from the backpack I'd carried on the plane. I take the elevator to the lobby, walking through the main area without meeting eyes with anyone. I start to think I'm home free, stepping outside into the sunlight, only to spot a group of teenagers hanging out at the front of the steps. I hope like hell they're not there for me. I aim for the other side of the stairs, ducking my head and walking fast. Just then I hear a gasp, followed by a squeal. And then suddenly the entire circle of girls is running at me. I curse Stuart for leaking my stay here, and also for what he would expect me to do, now that I've been found. Stop, smile, sign. Be thankful for fans. That is exactly what I've done for the past 10 years. As if there's actually a manual for this kind of thing, and I'm its poster boy. I nearly stop and turn around. Almost. But then something explodes inside me, and I'm suddenly running full out down the sidewalk until I hang a right onto a narrow cobblestone street. It's one way, and cars are coming toward me. I hug the side of the building to my right and keep going, ignoring the horns honking around me. I glance over my shoulder. 3 of the most determined girls are following me. They're doing a fine job of keeping up.
"Wait!"
one of them calls out in an English accent.
"Ren! We just want your autograph. We've bought all your songs."
I continue to run as if I've been doused in gasoline and they're carrying flaming torches. I'm only too aware of how easy it would be to hate me for this. How many guys wouldn't welcome the opportunity to be chased down an Italian street by 3 girls? Had it really been that long ago when I loved the attention, the adoration? When it somehow, even if temporarily, filled the hole inside me that seemed to not quite believe that any of it was real. I don't slow down until I no longer hear the click of their heels on the cobblestone street. I glance over my shoulder to see that they are no longer anywhere in sight. I begin to walk, dragging in ragged breaths that tell me how wrong I was to slack off on my running. I want to lean against the closest wall and slide to the ground, but I force myself to walk, one foot in front of the other, step after step until my breathing begins to slow and my chest no longer aches. I've reached a square by now that isn't one I recognize. Several people are throwing frisbees to their dogs. Other people sit on benches, watching, eating bread, sipping from bottles of water. I seek out the closest bench, sit down, and glance around the perimeter of the square to make sure the girls haven't caught up with me. I feel my phone vibrate in my back pocket. There's a text from Stuart. WTF, Wren, they've been waiting 2 days for you to come out. I consider not answering at all. I don't have to. But fury prompts my fingers to the keys. Did you not understand what I meant when I said I wanted some time alone? You're mostly going to get it. A few public sightings to keep you on your fans' radar. What's the harm in that? I want to be off radar. That's why I'm here. Nobody understands what's going on with you, man. Nobody needs to. I trusted you, Stuart. I'm sorry, Wren. It won't happen again. No, it won't. I send the text and turn off the phone altogether. I stick it in my pocket and head back to the hotel. I stop in a little shop along the way, buy a new hat, a jacket, and some different glasses. Just before reaching the hotel, I stop at the corner where I have a clear view of the entrance. The girls are no longer there. I suspect it's because Stuart has gotten worried enough to call his spies at the hotel and warn them to make everyone leave. I can't say that I'm sorry, but it's too little too late. I take the elevator to my room, pack what I have to pack, and again leave the hotel. I don't bother to check out because I don't want to give Stuart that much notice that I am no longer here. Outside, I ask the bellman for a taxi and wait with my head ducked while he summons one. When it pulls up, I hand him a tip and slide in the back. The driver glances at me in the rearview mirror, his face bland of any recognition, and says in heavily accented English, "Where to, signore?" "The train station," I say, and sit back.
10. Ty. Normally, you would have waited longer, given her more time to absorb who you are, what you are to this firm. More time to draw the conclusion that you're a man who's worth the risk. Normally, you let it be her idea. Even if you had to set her up a bit for it, you like for it to be her idea. It makes it way less complicated when things are over. How can she blame you when she's the one who started it? But this time you don't have to wait. Maybe this thing with Lizzie has you so thrown, for lack of a better word, that you need some kind of reset to remind you that you're the one in control of your marriage, not Lizzie. If she thinks she can do something like this without repercussion, she is wrong. You're sitting at your desk, tapping a pencil against a white legal pad, and working on your third cup of coffee when it occurs to you how incredibly stupid Lizzie is being. Did she forget that you're an attorney? You take satisfaction in knowing that if you ever decide to end your marriage, you've already made sure that Lizzie will never be able to touch the majority of your assets. You lean back in your chair, study the tan of your hands against your white shirt, and wonder if she knows exactly how easy it would be for you to trade her in for a newer model. Not that it hasn't occurred to you. It has. Many times. Until this very moment, you've actually preferred things the way they are. Lizzie has been a constant in your life. Home base, if you will. And you have a short attention span. You get bored easily. Maybe you're getting bored with Lizzie. The discontent you feel in her every evening when you get home from work. As if the life you share together is one she's merely tolerating. The irony of it is like acid in your gut. She doesn't work. You do. She has all day to run, read her books, take care of the house. Tough life. You can only imagine that there are plenty of women who would sign up for that lifestyle in a heartbeat. And so, when the new associate knocks at your door and steps inside with the glow of 20-something beautiful, you decide to test your theory.
11. Lizzie. I've spent the entire day, another long, glorious, self-indulgent day, meandering one street to another with no greater purpose than to see what lies at the end of the next street. I have my iPad with me and sit in an outside table of a trattoria, reading the first book on my very long list of books to read while I'm here. I take my time with the most delicious salad I've ever eaten. The greens are fresh, as if someone just picked them from a kitchen garden. The olive oil is smooth and flavorful and made only an hour or so away, according to my polite and slightly flirtatious waiter. Time has slowed for me here. I don't know if it's the fact that I don't have a cell phone attached to the palm of my hand or that there's no painfully long to-do list prodding me toward completion, or if it's that I am alone and I have nothing more to think about than what I will see next. Whatever it is, I'm beginning to love this pace of life. I think of how quickly an ordinary day at home goes by, swallowed in bits and pieces by the everyday tasks that seem so necessary there. Here, they don't seem necessary at all. Here, I wonder why the list of books that I would like to read has grown so long that I'm not sure I will actually finish them in my lifetime. Here, I read a book yesterday and will probably finish another today. As much as I love to read, it has become something that I never quite get to do. Ty hates it when I read in the evenings. He can't understand why I would want to disappear into the pages of a book instead of talking to him. But then our talking isn't exactly talking. It's more me listening while he talks about his day, the cases he's working on. I nod, shake my head, agree, and sympathize. I could resent this, except that I will be the first one to admit that his days are usually far more interesting than mine. There's only so much I can say about the 5-mile run I do each and every morning, or the trip to the dry cleaners or post office. And so at home, I've become an accomplished listener. Across the square, an elderly woman sits on a bench with her back to me. She's facing a church, centered nearly with the front doors of the beautiful building. Its walls are washed with age, the golden color streaked and mottled, gracefully aged in the way of so many of the buildings in Florence. Her dark hair, heavily streaked with gray, is anchored in a bun at the nape of her neck. Her shoulders are perfectly straight, her posture that of a 20-year-old runway model. I actually yearn for my camera. It's been so long since I've had that feeling that it startles me. To see something and recognize it as a moment that needs to be captured. It's a feeling I once loved completely. I brought my camera along on the trip, but I've yet to take it out of the hotel room. Somewhere along the way, my photography had become a hobby that seemed to take a little too much of my attention. I believe those were Ty's exact words. This, when Kylie had been a teenager and required more of my time than she had as a toddler. There had been practices to drive her to after school. Homework to help her with in the evenings. It was one evening in particular, when Kylie had been 14, that I finally realized what Ty thought of my work. He'd gotten home late from the office. It was 11 or so. I had been in the dining room, sorting photos on the table for a show I had been asked to take part in the following month. I'd been so intent on arranging the pictures that I hadn't noticed him standing in the doorway until he said, "Is there any purpose to what you're doing?" Startled, I glanced up, meeting his gaze. It only took that one look in his eyes for me to know he had been drinking. He could never hide it. Something about alcohol unveiled a meanness in Ty that was otherwise never really present in him. I saw it clearly then and stepped back automatically. "I'm working on these for the show at the museum on the 4th."
"Ah, yes. The one where we pay for a bunch of expensive frames to showcase your hobby."
It was a word he had certainly used before, a word I had come to dislike. In Ty's eyes, a label that made what I loved to do worthless. I guess that's the moment when I realized that's exactly how he saw it.
A nice little pastime for me that kept me from being too unhappy when he came home at this hour of the night on a regular basis. I hate to admit it, even now, because doing so casts me in a light I would rather not see myself in. A woman who started her adult life and her marriage with a clear identity, a very defined picture of who she wanted to be and how she saw myself getting there. The shoreline of that vision had really started to erode a long time ago. The waves small and so unobtrusive at first that I hadn't recognized the erosion. Over the years, the waves had continued to grow in size, eating away at my goals and ambitions, until that moment in our dining room when I realized they no longer had any value at all, at least in the context of my marriage. I can blame Ty for not realizing what his words did to me. I can blame him for thinking those thoughts in the first place. But I can't blame him for my own reaction to them. I can't blame him because I caved to them like a hollowed-out stretch of beach that finally redefines itself into the shape the ocean has forged for it. I let myself be changed by Ty's point of view. I began to see myself as he saw me, spending too much time each day, too much energy, too much money on something that really didn't and wouldn't ever matter very much to anyone but me. I backed out of the show, never discussing it with Ty, just removing it from our family calendar with the click of a delete button. Gone. Insignificant enough not to be noticed or questioned by either my husband or daughter. I don't know why I brought my camera on this trip. I haven't touched it in years. Maybe it was just one more outward sign of rebellion against Ty and his defaulting on our plans. I study the back of the woman's head again. Note the regal arch of her neck. I decide then and there that I have been missing out on too many beautiful moments. It doesn't matter if anyone else ever sees my pictures or not. They are for me, part of who I am and how I express my interpretation of what I see in this world. I've been silent too long. I pay my check and start walking back to the hotel. Adamant now that I will not pass one more beautiful thing in this city without my camera to remember it by. At the hotel, I step into the lobby, respond to the doorman's hope that I have enjoyed my day so far. We exchange pleasantries, his ability to express them in English far better than mine in Italian. He gives me a smile of approval at my willingness to try. I head for the elevator, and out of the corner of my eye, spot a tall, instantly familiar figure at the front desk. I stop before it even fully registers that I should keep going. The desk clerk looks up at me and smiles, causing the man to glance over his shoulder. He's wearing a ball cap and dark sunglasses. Maybe that would fool a lot of people, but I am as certain of who he is as I am certain of my own name. He meets my surely shocked gaze, and for what feels like an incredibly long stretch of seconds, we merely look at each other in silence, recognition clearly in place. His eyes, his very blue eyes, widen slightly. I feel my lips part with the intent of speaking, but something in his face stops me. He holds up a finger and says, "Wait, please." I actually glance over my shoulder to see if there is someone else behind me who he's talking to. His beautiful supermodel, perhaps. But there's no one there, just the elevator doors. And so I stand waiting while he signs a piece of paper, hands it back to the clerk, picks up his bag, and walks toward me. He nods his head at the elevator door and indicates for me to follow him. I do, mute, even though I cannot begin to understand my own actions. He might be a rock star to the rest of the world, but I don't know him, and I'm not in the habit of following strangers into elevators, which is exactly what I do when the doors slide open and he waits for me to step inside. He walks in behind me. The doors close. "Hello," he says. I try for the same, but the first attempt doesn't come out. "My hi," is hoarse at the edges, and there's a question mark at the end of it. "You're still here," he says. I try for a millisecond to figure out what that statement could possibly mean. So many things, and clearly none of them could be what I'm thinking. That he came here looking for me? Right. Yes, I say. I am. I had forgotten to push the button for my second floor room, and we glide to a stop on the fifth floor.
Can you get off here for a moment?
He asks. Here?
Here,
he says with a half smile on his mouth. Okay, I say, and follow him into the hallway. He checks his key, glances at the numbered plaques on the wall indicating room direction, and starts to the right. I say, I really should get back to my room.
Come inside for a second.
He holds up one hand as if to indicate harmlessness.
I'd rather not stand out here in the hallway.
I'm assuming by that he means he doesn't want to risk being recognized. Against the common sense I should certainly be exercising, I nod once and follow him silently to the end of the hallway, where he opens double doors into a room quite unlike mine. I love my room, but this is something else altogether. It occupies the front corner of the hotel. It's enormous. 3 sofas, several very cushy reading-type chairs, glass pane doors that open out onto a terrace. Another set of doors lead into what must be the bedroom, and I deliberately avert my gaze from there, settling instead on the terrace. He steps behind me to close the door. At the click of the lock, I jump a bit. He looks at me as if he has noticed my unease and says,
I'm not stalking you.
I laugh a little. Shouldn't I be the one stalking you? He shakes his head and says,
I didn't want you to think I followed you here with some evil purpose.
I try to frame a response at the same time I struggle to process exactly what he has said. But the two are in conflict, and what comes out is something between a laugh and a question.
You followed me here?
He shrugs.
I kind of got out of Rome fast. When I got to the train station and the agent asked me where to, Florence just came out.
Oh, I say, as if I understand now, when in actuality I am even more confused. Did something bad happen there?
Something normal, he says. I'm trying to get away from normal for a little while.
I slide my hands down the skirt of my dress, a casual flimsy thing I had slipped on this morning with very little thought as to whether anyone would notice it or whether I would care if they did. I'm finding right now that I do care. Well, Florence, it really is an awesome place. Room service here is wonderful. American coffee is incredible. I break off there, realizing I sound like an infomercial with selling points that he's probably already aware of. All right, then. I should be going. I actually came back to the hotel to get my camera before I finished my afternoon walking tour. Walking tour? Did I just say that? I sound like I'm at least 80 and traveling with the AARP.
Where are you going?
I feel my eyes widen at the question. I'm not exactly sure what I'm supposed to say. Is he asking out of polite interest? The Uffizi. To see David. You've been?
Yes, he says. It's pretty amazing.
Great. Well, I hope you...
Would you mind if I come along?
Is he serious? There has to be a punchline in here somewhere. Are you sure you want to do that? I ask, grappling for reasons why this would be a bad idea. I mean, you might be spotted or something.
I'm good,
he says.
If you are.
Ah, sure, I say. I need to run downstairs and get my camera.
Meet you in the lobby in 5 minutes.
Okay, I answer.
See you then, Lizzie.
My hand is on the doorknob when he says my name, and I feel a shock of pleasure at the realization that he has remembered it. Just as quickly, I push that away and open the door, stepping out into the hallway. I walk, more like a run, to the elevator, press the button repeatedly, as if that will make it arrive faster, until it glides to a stop.
The doors swish open. I step inside and push the second floor button, realizing I've been holding my breath since leaving his room.
I let it out and then breathe in a deep pull of air.
What just happened? I have no idea. It's as absolutely unlikely as any fantasy scenario I might ever have created for myself. At my room, I insert the key and push open the door, letting it slap closed behind me. I drop my purse onto the floor and press my palms to my cheeks, feeling the heat there. I walk to the mirror across from the bed and look at myself. My wavy blonde hair has refused to remain in submission to the taming I gave it with my flat iron earlier this morning. Curls have reasserted themselves. My lips are as pink as my cheeks, and my eyes are a little glazed as proof that I'm having trouble believing the past 10 minutes of my life. Maybe he won't show up downstairs and will avoid running into me for the rest of his stay here. This scenario makes sense. He seems like a nice enough guy on the surface. Maybe he's trying not to hurt my feelings. I go into the bathroom, reach for my toothbrush, and brush my teeth until I no longer taste anything of the wonderful lunch I'd consumed an hour or so ago. I wrangle a brush through my hair, consider quickly plugging in the flat iron, glance at my watch, and decide against it. Of course, if I'm operating under the assumption that he's not going to actually show up, I should use the flat iron. What difference will it make if I'm a few minutes late? Something inside me raises an unwelcome flag of hope, and I settle for the meager repair work of my hairbrush. I pull a tube of lipstick from my makeup bag, put some on, a subtle pink that brightens up my face and at the same time doesn't scream, "I'm trying way too hard." In the bedroom, I pull my camera bag from the drawer where I had stored it, slip it over my shoulder, grab my purse from the floor, and head for the door. The mirror stops me, beckons me to look. I do. And I'm not even sure I recognize who I see there looking back at me.
12. Ren. I wait for her in the lobby of the hotel. I stand away from the door with my back turned to anyone coming in. I can see the square outside the window, and I watch the faces of other people laughing, talking, and eating. Two girls walk past, glance in at me. I pull my cap lower so that it's shadowing most of my face. I look at my watch and realize it's been 20 minutes since I left my room. It occurs to me that maybe she won't come at all. Maybe she'll decide it was a crazy request on my part to ask to join her. And an even crazier response on her part to say that I could. I think about that taxi ride out of Rome and how I'd had no clear picture of where I was going. Not until I'd actually boarded the train and watched the Italian countryside flowing by outside my window. I knew that I was in a bad place and that despite my protest to Stuart, I didn't really want to be alone. I wanted to be away, but not alone. Alone is dangerous. Alone means I have to trust myself to leave that bottle in my leather case. But sometimes the temptation is so great that I can barely resist it. I know that what's in that bottle will bring oblivion, freedom from my thoughts. Sometimes I crave it to the point that it is all I can think about. On the train headed toward Florence, I had actually let myself play through the scenario. It would be so easy. I know how many pills I would have to take. I know how long before that amount would be likely to stop my heart. There's something I can only describe as comfort in this hidden knowledge. It's like a concealed weapon that I carry to protect myself from the bad stuff. Only the irony is that the bad stuff doesn't exist in the form of some lunatic hijacking my car or shooting me when I open the front door of my apartment. The bad stuff exists within me, and those pills are there to protect me from myself. I hear footsteps behind me and turn to see Lizzie Harper stop several yards away from me, as if she's afraid to come closer. "Hey," I say.
"Hey,"
she replies back, clearly nervous. We study each other for a second or two and then start to speak at the same time. I stop and let her speak first.
"Where do you want to go?"
she asks. "Wherever you were headed before I asked to come with you." I see the questions in her face, and if I were a kinder person, I would say something to address them. But what explanation could I give her that wouldn't have her calling for the nearest psychiatrist? And would I even blame her? No, I wouldn't.
13. Lizzie. I am walking down a street in Florence, Italy, with Ren Sawyer. Granted, no one else would know he's Ren Sawyer. Between the hat, the hoodie, and the sunglasses, there's little chance of anyone recognizing him. Clearly, that's his intent. My stomach is so full of butterflies that I actually feel sick. I don't think I could make a coherent sentence come out of my mouth right now if my life depended on it. My brain ends everything that starts to my lips, disqualifying it as inane, boring, and not even remotely in the ballpark of anything a rock star would talk about. As for me knowing what that might be, he could belong to another species. Which, actually, I guess he does, if you are dividing human beings into groups of like and unalike. People who live on similar planets, and people who don't. I settle for a question, the most obvious one. Why would you want to do this?
What?
He asks, and I can tell he's stalling. Come with me. Don't people like you have bodyguards, guided tours, and stuff like that?
Sometimes, he says. Although it gets old pretty fast.
Just warning you, if a crowd gathers and they get a little crazy, I'm probably not going to be much of a bodyguard. He laughs at this, and when I glance at him, I really have to wonder if he's as surprised by the laughter as I am. I don't know what it is. I can't exactly put my finger on it, but there's this air about him that feels heavy and weighted, a curtain put in place to prevent others from seeing it. His laugh is like a break in that curtain, through which I glimpse someone very different from the guy in all those pictures generated by my nosy Google search. As quickly as it had appeared, the smile slips away again, and in its place, his former seriousness returns.
That's okay, he says. I won't expect you to.
Does it happen often? I ask.
What?
Things getting out of control when people recognize you?
Not as much as it used to. I've gotten a little wiser.
Ah, I say, as if I know exactly what he means when how could I possibly have any idea. I was headed to the Uffizi this afternoon. We can do something else if you'd rather.
No, I'd like to see it again.
We cover blocks and blocks then, without speaking further, just walking, like two people who might know each other well enough not to need conversation, except that the explanation for our silence is something altogether different. When I start to become uncomfortable with it, I pull my camera from its bag. I loop the strap around my neck, settle one hand on each side, remembering how much I love the feel of it.
Nice,
he says, looking at it. Thanks. I haven't used it in a while. There's a stand up ahead operated by an older man with gray hair and a sun-lined face. His cart contains clear cups of deep red cherries. Next to that is a display of sliced coconut on ice. Enormous lemons line the top of the cart. A sign says, Fresh Squeeze Lemonade. His setup is small and simple, but utterly beautiful. My fingers itch to capture that beauty. I raise the camera, adjust the zoom, and click. It is the first picture I've taken in years. Just like that, I feel a little piece of myself pop back into place, like a joint that's been dislocated and then returned to its correct fit. I don't think I realized how truly painful giving up my photography has been, until now when I once again feel the satisfaction it gives me. I've snapped at least 20 shots when the man running the stand smiles at me and says,
You like?
Very much, I say.
I am in one,
he says. Yes, of course, I answer, smiling. He doesn't pose, merely works at arranging the cups of fresh cherries at a better angle, adding slices of coconut to the ice. His white apron makes a nice offset against the vibrant colors of the fruit. He looks up once and smiles at me, his very white teeth gleaming against his sun-bronzed skin. A customer walks up to buy a cup of cherries. The proprietor nods at me and says,
"Thank you for me to be in the photograph."
"No, thank you," I say, stepping back. I bump into someone and turn suddenly, realizing that it is Ren, and at the same time becoming